Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So NASA is looking for alternatives to Earth. What if there was a nice place outside the solar system, temperature about 70 degrees Fahrenheit, say twice the size of Earth, with a decent star in a stable orbit? Maybe no shiny moon, but hey, that's just a cosmetic thing anyway. Oh, and we're not completely sure if there's any solid ground on this planet, but it might end up being just a gas ball. A little risky, but Neil, would you go there?
Of course. Send me now.
Of course. Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, also host of Star Talk Radio. I'm talking about a piece of real estate that actually seems to have been detected by the NASA Kepler project. Explain the details.
Well, the Kepler is a telescope that actually is in a trailing orbit to Earth around the sun. There are interesting places to put telescopes that are not on Earth's surface. One of them is where Kepler is. And it's specially tuned to look for planets that are orbiting other stars, but planets that are small enough that could rival the size of the Earth. All previous measurements of what we call exoplanets, these planets that are in other star systems, have been, those methods and tactics have tended to find primarily Jupiter-sized planets. And so all the earlier work was important for establishing that other star systems exist. But Kepler is the one that's going to bring us in the Holy Grail.
And tell us a little bit more about Kepler 22b. Not a great name, but could be a great place.
Yeah, it's in desperate need of a naming contest, I think. But the Kepler 22b is a planet that is Earth-sized. It's a little bigger than Earth, about twice the size of Earth, but it's not 20 times bigger than Earth, and it's not like an asteroid, right? So it's close enough to Earth size so that you can imagine life as we know it being on it. But that's not what really distinguishes it. In this particular case, what distinguishes it is that it's orbiting its host star. The host star is sun-like. It's orbiting a sun-like star in the distance, what I call the Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold. So not too close, not too far away from the star, so that you can sustain liquid water.
Interesting. Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium. How far away is this place?
Oh, I mean, from us, yes.
Yeah.
So it's about 600 light years away.
Mm-hmm.
But one problem is, that's not far given the size of the galaxy, but given our current technology of getting places, it's hopeless.
Right.
At the moment, I'm very disappointed that, it would take us, given the fastest hardware we've ever launched, it would take us about 70,000 years to get to the nearest star, so which is, about four or five light years away. So this is 600 light years away. So it's not something we're going to visit anytime soon.
I'll put that out of my mind then. The one detail that was in the Kepler report, the NASA report, suggests that they can't really detect if it's gas or solid. Is it possible for life to develop on a gaseous world? Do you need solid, an actual solid ground?
Yeah, it's not obvious for life as we know it to develop on a gaseous world. So that's not obvious. However, it's really unlikely that a planet that small would be gaseous. It's just unlikely. I'll tell you why. Because most of the gas that would comprise a planet, such as Jupiter, is very light. Jupiter is mostly hydrogen and helium. And light gases tend to move very quickly. The molecules tend to move very quickly. And if you're not very big, you can't hold on to those fast-moving molecules. And they just escape. So Earth might have had a lot of sort of free hydrogen and helium in the early solar system, but our gravity's too feeble to hold on to it. And we keep the heavier gases, the nitrogen, the oxygen that's here.
All right, so Neil, which is more...
Hello, Celeste.
Hello, good morning. Let me just ask you, which is more exciting to you, this discovery of not just this planet, but the numbers, I guess, a thousand or so planets that kind of fit in that Goldilocks zone, or these enormous black holes?
Oh, yeah. So another coincident discovery is that a couple of monstrous black holes were just reported, and using a combination of telescopes, including Hubble, there are clusters of galaxies out there. We're in a galaxy, the Milky Way, but there are places where there are thousands of galaxies all enjoying each other's gravity in a cluster. And those clusters tend to have sort of the big man on campus within those clusters. And you can ask, why are those galaxies bigger than others? members in the cluster, is there something going on deep within them? So you study them closer, and you find out that they have monstrous, supermassive black holes in their centers. And two such galaxies were reported, one with 20 billion times the mass of our sun, and another with about 10 billion times the mass of the sun. These are far and away the most massive black holes ever found.
So let's go back to the chain of experimental logic here. Large galaxies suggest black holes at the center, and when you find those black holes, they have a mass, as you said, 10, 20 billion times the size of our sun. Are black holes size limited in any way?
There is no evidence that a black hole can ever be too large. It's just, you know, there was a previous record holder, which was in the center of a pretty massive galaxy that we know of, which is relatively nearby. These other two black holes are much farther away in clusters of galaxies that are farther away. What's interesting to me is what we've learned over the last couple of decades is that every galaxy where we've had good enough data to see what was going on in the center, we found a supermassive black hole. Mm. So we're going to be audacious enough now and say supermassive black holes are natural consequences of the formation of a galaxy. And so now that you have the really big ones, by the way, in the early universe, there are things called quasars. It's more than just,
right.
It was just a TV. It was an actual cosmic object, copious amount of energy coming out of it. We never really understood what caused it. And it could have been those are the formations of black holes in the early universe. And when we see them nearby, that's the remnant of what was once these quasars.
And the quasar, I think the TV was named after the original astronomical object. So the evidence for supermassive black holes is now much more than just the jets of X-ray radiation and the huge amounts of energy that's pouring out of the center. You're actually observing things.
That's an excellent point, because originally we just saw this extreme energy coming out in jets and high energy radiation, and you see something nasty is going on down there, and you can infer that there was a black hole. These measurements are, you're actually looking at how fast stars are moving down near the center of the galaxy, and you see them just whizzing really, really fast, and then you look at what they're whizzing around, and nothing's there.
You don't see anything there.
So you do the calculation. We have equations for this. You say, how can something move that fast? But you can't see it, all right? And something that small forcing something else to move that fast, you completely describe the size of these black holes.
Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, I love the way you say really, really, really fast. Astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium.
We can quantify that if you need it, but that, really
definitely,
work for the morning.
It works for me. American Museum of Natural History, host of Star Talk Radio. Neil, thanks so much.
Good to be on. Thanks.
The sky calls to us if we do not destroy ourselves.